We're going to abbreviate some of our bills today. We're not going to be considering 3510, 3575, or Senate Bill 2 today. But start with open to work session on House Bill 2817, Representatives Walker and Posonski.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
I'm a slow start here.
I can see. It looks like bright early and sun shining and members are coming in.
Here's the revenue impact from the local tariffs.
Welcome back. Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Floyd Pogonski, State Representative, House District 40. And we're here today at the request of the Chair and the Committee as to some amendments that were requested that we have drafted. And we have had those drafted. The A5s are still the same as they were previously presented to the Committee. I believe that was on Monday. And we have drafted the A6. I'll take that back. A5 is new to the committee. It's been reformulated to be in line with the A engrossed bill, and the A6 is also reformatted to the A engrossed bill. We're asking the committee to adopt the A6 amendments that are proposed because it would, in fact, do the following thing. Number one, it would limit any type of tax credit to individuals who remove their home heating oil tank and learn or find in that process that there has been a leak in the tank and that it has contaminated the soil. And so the tax credit would be applied or given to individuals on an economic scale basis as it was reflected previously in the engrossed bill. On a pro rata basis for the cleanup of the soil that has been contaminated. Again, this is not intended to provide for any type of tax credit where a person removes the tank and there's no or any contamination to the soil. And doing that, what we wanted to do was bring down and what we thought was the intent of our measure after it was originally drafted, was to limit it to this group of individuals. And it's my understanding the revenue impact that has been completed on this shows that there would be an impact of someplace in the range of 2.3 in revenue based on the personal income tax on the general fund for this. We do believe that this is an appropriate means of dealing with the issue. Where an individual has taken the incentive to clean or remove a tank but finds that the soil has been contaminated, it's a risk for not only that landowner, homeowner, I should say, but also for the people who are in that immediate area because the biggest potential problem by not cleaning up the contaminated waste is the movement of the oil into the groundwater. And it is also something we feel that can be a significant financial hardship on the homeowner if it is not they do not receive some type of offset. I would just encourage the committee when you look at the original or the A engrossed bill, you'll see how the breakdown was set up for the individual to be able to receive a percentage of the cost for the cleanup of the contaminated soil. Again, if a person has a federal adjusted gross income of not over $25,000, they would be entitled to a 100% set off, and it goes down to where over $75,000, it would be limited to 20%. The other change that's in the A6 is that it caps the length of time that an individual could actually carry forward that tax credit to the fifth year. This is again an attempt to not one prolong the length of time that was originally drafted in there was a 15 years, and we feel that that is an appropriate time to allow for someone to carry forward a tax credit. If they use it, great. If they aren't able to use it within 5 years, then they would lose it.
And Mr. Sheriff, I'm not Representative Vicki Walker, District 41. The other change for the A6 amendment was that we deleted the provision of just simple removal of a tank and limited it to contamination cleanup.
Mr. Chair, you did also ask that the A5 be presented. This is the one that would require the individual who would be removing these type of tanks to be certified or regulated through the DEQ, and that they have met the base agreements. This is one that we're standing silent, not in or against in support. Chair Welsh asked that be included when he was reviewing the bill originally in Water and Environment, so that's now before you. I understand, and I see Representative Byers here, that he has submitted an A7. I have not had an opportunity really to review it myself in great detail, but it appears that there's a procedure that would allow for the individuals to voluntarily process a decommissioning of a abandoned underground heating oil tank. And
well, Representative Byer, why don't you join
us
at the table here, and then we'll have be able to discuss all three of these amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. Would you like me to go into the A7 amendments? Okay. I'd first like to apologize to the sponsor of the bill for not having a chance to get to her first and discuss the amendments with her. I originally drafted these amendments for a different bill, and that bill doesn't seem to be moving, so now we had to go find one that is moving. What the A7 is intended to do is that currently, it was brought to my attention early in the session that the DEQ is charging a $500 deposit to people who need to decommission an oil tank. They are using this deposit as a way to recover costs, is what the statute says. They are able to recover their costs, and the cost of decommission is a fuel tank. Nowhere in the statute does it say that they have the right to charge a deposit up front, a retainer, or a trust fund, use the money they need out of that, and then give the leftover back to the person who is decommissioning the tank. This amendment says is intended to do is say that they cannot charge an upfront fee. They can only charge their costs after the fact. And then if the person does not pay that after the fact, you can go through the Attorney General in order to get the money. It was brought to my attention by a constituent of mine who was working on this. And, you know, after they decommissioned the tank, spend several thousands of dollars doing the work, they then get told by DEQ before they can get the, and all DEQ has to do is go out and certify that it was done. Before they can do that, they have to pay a $500 deposit before they'll even come out and to look at it, do the work, do the paperwork, which amounts to maybe an hour worth of paperwork, the travel time from Salem out. And so that's the attempt here, is just to keep DEQ from, you know, holding people up with a upfront cost, you know, let them recover their costs after the fact, but let's not tax people in advance.
Okay, questions on any of these amendments? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this would be, I guess, to any of you that would like to respond. The tax credit that is provided for in this bill is a percentage of the expense incurred based upon income. I'd like to know why that's appropriate to make this tax credit based upon the taxpayer's income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, the discussion that we had was knowing and hearing from the individual that brought this forward, Robert Justine, who works for state and companies, what he has seen in his experience and what I guess could relate to as well is that these financial hardships will hit someone more at a greater level if you have less of an income than someone that has a greater income. because of the potential impact of the number of tanks, I believe the range is somewhere around a third of the get what the numbers we had. I think it was around 1,500 or 2,000 actually had sites that were contaminated.
Yeah, the revenue impact and assumed the cleanup of 2,000 contaminated sites.
And realizing based on the revenue average of $3,250 per site on the cost, what we're looking at is that would be a significant revenue hit to allow it to be 100% across the board. So then what we thought when we would attempt to do is make it as equitable as we could, and it was our choice to allow individuals such as someone that's on a fixed income, a senior, be able to have the work done and not basically bankrupt them.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. One of my concerns is that we are taking a procedure associated with a particular industry, the oil heating industry, and we're saying that the problems created within the practices of that industry should be solved through the general fund rather than by fees within the industry. We previously had a fee that didn't cover everyone, but it did cover those who stuck with the heating oil when they had a problem with their tank. And I think as you're aware that was amended last session and led to kind of a dysfunction of the heating oil commission. But how do we explain or justify shifting these costs to the general public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I think it's pretty easy. Bottom line is what we're talking about is a potential health hazard to more than just the homeowner. If you allow contaminants to go into the groundwater and at that point contaminate people's ability to potentially get water out of wells or other things, you really are talking about a greater wrong and harm to the public beyond the confines of a real property border. And being here in 97 and knowing what we passed and seeing what the results of that passage is to nothing ever occurring from the industry, I question as to the wisdom of trying to somehow tie that back as an industry problem. I see this as the same unfortunate result of a process that people have used to to heat their homes, and it was a very open, accepted practice in this state in earlier years. We are now learning from, experience as to the health hazards that are caused by having underground tanks. And it only seems appropriate that we as a state address this issue instead of trying to take it with one component of or one industry.
A number of folks who have studied this have said that the oil that remains in tanks is the biggest environmental threat and that the most cost-effective way to address it is to simply get that oil that's still sitting in those tanks, which are abandoned, pumped out. It seems like we could create an incentive at much less cost to the state to simply get the pumps tanked, the tanks pumped, so that...
Can we fill that up?
Already a long week. And I was wondering if you all had explored this option, and if so, what you had found and why you chose to focus on the angle that you've focused on rather than getting the tanks pumped out.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I guess I would say that you're looking at two different stages. One, what I'm hearing you say is being proactive, and I think that's great. We should be doing that because if you're not proactive, we're trying to address the issue that is the reactive end, and that is the more time those tanks have oil in there, the more likelihood you're going to have contamination of the soil. So I commend you as to saying that we may want to do something in that area, and that's my understanding is pump a tank, you're talking about $90, maybe $100. To have that done, at least from my discussions with Mr. Despain. I would think that that's probably something that's pretty much in reason for a homeowner to be able to accomplish. I guess the thing is, the flip side of that is, as you may want to be exclusively proactive and pumping out existing oil in tanks that are not leaking, what are you going to do with the ones that have already leaked and already contaminating the soil in that vicinity?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, luckily I appreciate that might be just a simple answer, but it's not, because you don't know that the tanks are leaking oftentimes until you go down and decommission them. Soil samples need to be taken to determine whether there's been a leak, and it's an incredible environmental problem. It really is irresponsible if we as a state don't become proactive on this issue, because we're all affected by this groundwater problem, particularly the rural areas who derive a lot of their water from wells. So I just don't, just taking the oil out of the tank isn't going to work. And in some communities, my own, mine and Representative Levanski, you can't just decommission the tank. In our community, you have to remove it. If you're not going to use it anymore, you can't fill it with sand like you could in the old days. They want you to remove it because they want you to look for groundwater contamination.
Okay, any other, regarding work sessions, anybody got any objections with any of these amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I just want to point out that Senate Bill, there's an active Senate Bill 542, that is a DEQ bill that deals with requiring a licensing to perform remedial action on heating oil tanks. It's a way to deal with the -7 Roger Byers bill, and it's great that many minds think alike. That Roger, or Mr. Representative Byer in my own communities, it's very clear that finding out that you have tanks that you got to yank at the moment you're trying to sell a house is a very difficult thing. And there is a bill, 31, that is very active in our process, as well as another bill, 3107, which also deals with changes to the regulations, and it's already worked with DEQ, been coming through this process, and I think it's, I don't want to take away from Representative Byers' energy at all, but it's already been through a pretty rigorous process, and it might be better to let it move forward than pick up the contents of the -A7 amendments at this point in time.
Do you have any response to that?
Mr. Chair, can you give me those bill numbers again? I was not aware of other bills dealing with this issue.
There are two bills, Senate Bill 542 and House Bill 3107. House Bill 3107.
Mr. Welsh.
542 last week was passed out of House Water Environment onto the floor. It was coming to the House floor this week, possibly. 3107 is passed on, as I understand it, in Ways and Means.
Yes, it is. It's come out of Commerce. It's on its way to Ways and Means.
Okay, and what does 542 do? Does it do the -7, essentially?
No, I can't tell you that for sure right now. I don't think there was any language in there. That's why I like what Representative Byer brought forward here on the voluntary language here in Section 4.
Well, I thought I heard Representative Rasmussen. I thought you said that one of those had to do with having the contamination removal performed by a qualified person, and that's the -5.
That would be -5.
Okay, well, both in the -7 also deals with some changes in the changes and rules, a voluntary process for decommissioning abandoned underground heating oil tanks that's involved in the two bills as well. This is, if you like, I have brought the file folders down, and you can take a look at them. I can spend time reading them into the record.
Well, I really don't want to. Well,
I didn't think you wanted
to. I don't want to spend a lot of, not more time.
What I'm trying to tell you, though, is that the -7s and, for that matter, I guess the -5s are being dealt with in another bill. And I'm concerned that we might end up with conflicting bill issues going on here.
Mr. Chair, I mean, we might have conflict amendments to resolve them.
I'd like to point out that the main thrust of the Dash 7 is not Section 4, but Section 5, which says that the Department of DEQ cannot charge an upfront fee as a deposit. That's the main issue here, and I don't think that is actually addressed into the bill. If there is conflict with that versus other parts of, the, of this bill or other bills, Legislative Council will always have draft conflict amendments can be put on the Senate to resolve those conflicts. So I would urge passage of the Dash A7 also to make sure that people are not charged upfront costs rather than just recover costs, which the statute say.
Right. There's also no guarantee that all these bills are going to make it through.
Same point, Mr. Chair. Representative Federer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of the Dash A7s, it refers to the bringing of an action to recover the certification costs, and it says that an action can be brought to recover the amount owed plus reasonable legal expenses. You know, is that intended to contemplate attorney fees, or normally attorney fees would say attorney fees. Legal expenses would be your filing fees, but you'd get those anyway. That's an ordinary, you ordinarily recover that in a cost bill. I'm not sure what legal expenses would be there. Do you know what you contemplated there?
Mr. Chair, the issue here is the fact that if the Attorney General has to go out and help recover these fees, it would allow them to recover their costs in doing so. You know, the Attorney General, they don't charge legal fees, I understand. They have legal expenses because they're a state agency. I think it's terminology.
Yeah.
A problem?
Well, I'm not sure. I appreciate that. I think there is a difference in the way, and Representative Williams can help me out here, but I think there is a difference in the way the courts treat fees and expenses. I mean, expenses are out-of-pocket costs. You pay your filing fee, your trial fee, your hearing fee, those kind of things. And I think unless the statute says fees, then I don't think fees are generally recoverable. That is the hourly cost of the of the attorney, or in this case, the department. If fees are what was contemplated there, I might at least propose a. This isn't a motion, but let's see if anybody would be willing to consider a conceptual amendment to insert fees there.
Mr. Chair, if I could address this, the Attorney General, of course, bills the other agencies for their work.
Right.
And the attempt here is to so that the DEQ could recover the cost of the Attorney General billing to them, and that is the issue that the Department of Iowa.
Mr. Muir was here a minute ago. He's going to be back on this other bill. If he's hanging around outside the room, maybe we can get his opinion on it. Representative Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Shirley is right. At least how the courts interpret statutes involving any recovery of attorney's fees. It needs to say fees. Typically, when it's simply said costs, the courts have interpreted those cases to not include fees. So if that's what we're talking about, we probably want to insert that just to be absolutely clear that that's where Representative Beyer wants to go with this language. Otherwise, we potentially run afoul of a whole progeny of court opinions.
Mr. Chair, I think, and you know, I'm not an attorney, obviously, but if you want to, if you want to substitute the word fees for the word expenses on line 5 of page 2, I would have no objection to that.
Or even, Mr. Chair, insert fees
and expenses. Yeah.
That would get to both the fees and any additional expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Mr. Muir, I know this is a spontaneous question, but the question was whether reasonable legal expenses is a phrase for compensating the Attorney General office that would be different from reasonable legal or attorney's fees. Is there any difference there? We're dealing with the AG's office.
Bob Muir, Assistant Attorney General. Your Chair, thank you very much for recognizing me. I'm not here on this bill, but I
know. That's how we take the opportunity.
We saw you walking by.
Any attorney in the forum, Mr. Muir? Question is on page 2, line 5.
Well,
that should be attorney fees or legal expenses. Only lawyers would bring up these questions.
I would say that the terms are sufficiently vague that we'll have arguments about them, because it isn't so much reasonable in a court of competent jurisdiction to recover the amount owed, plus you're in a court will adjudicate it. That's not so bad. But what is it supposed to cover? The attorney's fees, the costs. I saw in a bill just this session that deposition costs are an element of recovery that is specifically identified, but typically that's not a cost you do recover. So my advice to you would be that if you really want to remove doubt, you should provide a definition of what it encompasses.
Okay. I think we're hearing that with a lot of the attorney's fees that I'm hearing. Pardon me? Mr. Chair, I would say fees and expenses, because that would encompass both the actual work and any costs that are associated to that litigation.
Okay. Okay, so do you want to propose a special amendment to, or I move to suspend the rules of the committee. Does anybody object? So ordered. Okay, Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, actually what I would propose would be to, on line 5, I would move to a conceptual amendment after the word legal to delete expenses and insert fees and costs. And I say that again because costs really is a term of art. Expenses is not. I would say fees and costs. So that would be plus reasonable legal fees and costs.
Okay, Representative Shetterly proposes a conceptual amendment to the -87 amendments on page 2, line 5, to delete the word expenses and instead insert fees and costs. Is there any discussion, any objection? Okay, we'll do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I'd like to have DEQ explain why they operate in their current fashion. They are largely fee-driven, and I don't think that they're too interested in suing citizens for $100 or $200, and I doubt that that's productive to our relationship. I think we should at least hear why they've embarked on doing it the way that they do it before we make a decision to end that practice. I must say, I'm quite sympathetic. My father went through that $500 fee, and at first it struck me as totally unreasonable. He did eventually get the bulk of it back. But I guess I'd like to hear why it's done that way before we choose not to. And I don't believe that this conflicts with anything in the other pieces of legislation from what I've seen. I think it stands on its own. So.
Is anybody here from DEQ? I don't see anyone here from DEQ or saying anything. Okay, we're in work sessions. Anyone have any motions on this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merkley.
I would like to move A7 into HB 2817.
Representative Merkley moves the adoption of the -A7 amendments, House Bill 2817. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be opposing them.
Okay. Representative Rasmussen objects. Any other objections? A7s are adopted. Chair would move the -A6 amendments, House Bill 2817. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I object.
Any Witt objects? And I would also, Chair moves adoption of the A5 amendment to House Bill 2817. Any discussion? Any objection to that one? It's adopted also.
Mr. Chair.
Jay Merkley.
I'd like to move HB 2817 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Can you state why you're moving it to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, we already have Bill 107 in Ways and Means, and I think that we have these three different bills. One has passed the floor, but two haven't, and I feel like we will be able to do much more reasonable legislation if these closely related bills are considered at the same time. And I think it will also give DEQ a chance to appear and respond to their current procedures so that we don't pass that through without giving them a chance to comment on it.
Other discussion? Ed, does this have a referral to Ways and Means on it?
I don't believe so.
Mr. Chair, let's report the motion. I am concerned that we do have very tightly interlocked bills at this point in time, and somewhere they need to be brought together and reviewed.
Any other discussion on the motion? Does not have a referral, required referral away from me.
Does not have a prior referral away from me.
Might I speak to that, Mr. Chair?
Okay, Walker.
Well, I don't have a vote in this, but I don't support the referral to waive means because the other bills don't deal with tax credits on decommissioning underground storage tanks. Senate Bill 542 deals with an advisory committee. There's no fiscal impact on this bill. It's a revenue bill. It's totally within your purview to review this and pass it out. I just think it's an unnecessary waste of time.
I completely agree, and especially at this point in the session, to move a House bill to Ways and Means that where the substantive issue has already been dealt with in water and environment, and where we're dealing with the revenue impact, where it has no Ways and Means requirement.
I'm concerned about the dash A7s. I don't know if that throws that into a Ways and Means issue with from moving around with fees and things, and when you can charge those fees. If you are now not charging fees up front or in back, I think that my experience with the DEQ folks is that the legislatures have chosen to short-staff them, and they find it very difficult to do their work, including, and one of the reasons why we're really struggling with underground oil tanks is they don't have the staff to help homeowners get the stuff up and out of the ground, and my concern is that the Dash A7s move exasperate that problem, exasperate their staffing, and I think it's another reason to move it toward Ways and Means.
Well, I believe that the Dash A7s say that there can be reasonable cost recovery for any expenses that DEQ incurs. It just says it's not a revenue-raising fee that's permitted without any relationship to actual costs.
Mr. Chair, if I may address that, I think you're exactly right. Under current law, the DEQ is required to only recover costs. So if they, in fact, are charging upfront money and then not refunding everything that's not cost, that's the only way it could impact their budget, is the fact that if they are not giving back the full amount due to the homeowner, this still allows them to recover their costs. So it should not. It should have no fiscal impact whatsoever on the department.
Representative Merkley, you have a motion before us. My concern is if this goes to Ways and Means, it probably will never see the light of day in the rest of this session. So that's the motion before us, unless you want to amend your motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to support the bill, and there's a number of folks here who want to support it but feel uncomfortable doing so with the patchwork nature. Obviously, if this motion fails, that's the rule of trade. I'm very comfortable with that. I'd like to I think it's a better strategy for us to combine the DEQ bill with this bill and to have DEQ have a chance to comment on something that clearly is very much related to their function. I'd like to do the motion on the table.
Representative Wells, as I understand, with the working group here around this issue, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of work with DEQ, and I have had also a discussion with the co-chair of Ways and Means, and asking that they certainly, before they finish off DEQ's budget, they will provide us a complete fix. We have substantive legislation, and we do need to make sure that Ways and Means will appropriately adjust for the heating oil tanks, underground tank issue in this state. And then we will have a complete approach to taking care of this. And I was assured by the co-chair that they would take care of that with the bill that we have down there. And there was certainly plenty of involvement and discussion with the EQ on this. And they have also, I know, talk with the chair, so we will hopefully pass this to the floor and take care of the substantive portions of this, and the revenue portions
and Ways and Means will do their work.
Mr. Trey,
I think we've spent way much time on this, so the motion before us is to move the bill to Ways and Means. Please call the roll.
Representative Support.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Ketterer.
No.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
No. No.
Aye.
Aye.
No. House Bill 2017 will move to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you,
Chair. For the record, my vote on that was not in opposition to the bill, but to the referral.
To the referral. As was mine.
As was mine, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. I'd like to note that it's because of the strong support for engaging this process in Ways and Means, it's my understanding that this is not at all an effort to, for this bill not to see the light of day, as the Chair mentioned. It's my understanding that Ways and Means is very prepared to deal with this issue and intends to send it to the floor.
We'll see. Close the work session on House Bill 2017. Open work session on Senate Bill 245. This is the bill that has to do with property tax exemption for Indian property, Indian country. Mr. Muir?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Muir, Assistant Attorney General, Attorney in Charge of Tax and Finance at the Department of Justice. The Department of Revenue asked me to draft something for submission to the Legislative Assembly this session, following two significant pieces of advice that we provided them regarding exemption of Indian property. One was, I believe, involving cigarette taxes in Southern Oregon and the Cow Creek Band of the Umpqua. And in that case, in looking at what had happened in the jurisprudence concerning taxation of Indian property and Indian income in that case, we became aware of the decision in an Oklahoma case, which I'm scrambling to pull out right now. Yeah, and this is the Citizens Band Potawatomi Indian Tribe of Oklahoma, a 1991 Supreme Court decision in which the Supreme Court is moving away from the terminology of reservations and saying that any trust land that is set aside for the residents of the Indians is subject to general immunity from state jurisdiction, and taxation is one of those jurisdictions. And the other involved a mobile home on tribal land, and the question is whether that as personal property would be exempt. The final thing, and in the process of drafting, Revenue said, could you make it simpler? This statute has terminology like lands taken in severalty and property owned by or held by the Indians in severalty, and notice the distinction owned and held by. What is held by? It's obviously something other than ownership. So could you simplify it? And the bill draft that you have before you is the product of those three objectives. Change the terminology from reservation to Indian country. Make it clear that the general rule of law is that personal property within the tribal trust lands is exempt. And finally, simplification. Now, a disclaimer about simplification, because this issue has been raised. Would this bill exempt Indian property that is otherwise taxable under federal law? Yes, but to a very limited extent. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Cass County, Minnesota case, and one other case, the Yakima case that came out of the state of Washington, has held that under a specific series of federal statutes, from 1887 to the early 1930s, there was a change in federal policy with respect to the taxation of Indian land. The policy prior to that time and the policy since that time is that land set aside in trust to the Indians are exempt from state taxation. But during that period, the federal policy was to integrate Indians into the mainstream of U.S. society, and so allotment of Indian lands during that period, which were freely alienable, and alienability means the ability to transfer without restriction, but those lands given to the Indians, which were freely alienable, were subject to taxation, and here's another little technical issue, after being held in trust for 25 years. So you'd have to have a date of transfer. When did it go to the Indian? Was it under one of these statutes? And is the 25-year period expired? Those elements, those technical elements, and the fact that this period of time where the federal policy was to permit taxation of lands raises a lot of very difficult issues for county assessors to deal with. And so the Department of Revenue's decision on that was simply to not make an exception for this period of time. Treat them all the same. They're all exempt. I don't believe there's any study as to the number of parcels that fit within this exception, but I suspect that it is few. But I thought, in terms of explaining what the effect of the bill was, you need to understand there is a change with respect to exemption. It expands the exemption to include some parcels of land that are currently taxable under federal law and under state statutes. And that's really the summary of the history of my involvement with the bill and its purposes. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
In the letter that you sent to Mr. Maneri dated May 12th, your question was asked about the actual definition of the term Indian country. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has changed the expression but hasn't provided us with a definition. And in that specific case where the court was quite firm. If you read the opinion, you'll find that the court is quite firm about its statement that the exemption is not to apply simply to formal reservations, that all trust land set aside to the Indians. It refers to Indian country and provides two different expressions to describe what it means by Indian country. One is from the treatise by Cohen on Indian law, and I quote it on page 2 of my letter. And then later in the opinion, quoting from itself, or just stating the expression in its own words, the Supreme Court says Indian country is a formal or informal reservation, allotted lands, or dependent Indian communities. And those, conceivably, because different words are used in the two different definitions, conceivably could mean different things. Right? They shouldn't mean different things, but why did the Supreme Court use a definition from a treatise in one place and then an expression in the other? If you were to choose one of those two expressions, you might, as a definition of Indian country for purposes of this bill, you might simply combine them and say that Indian country means all land set aside by whatever means for the residents of tribal members under federal protection, together with trust and restricted Indian allotments, or formal or informal Indian reservation allotted land for dependent Indian communities, and just lump all the words together. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't give us one coherent definition.
So if we're trying to accomplish clarity for county assessors, does this really do that? Isn't there also confusion or ambiguity about using that definition?
Mr. Chair, yes, there definitely is. You're still left, even with a definition, I might add, you know, what are allotted lands? These words are not going to speak up and mean something definite. But I guess the question in terms of the utility of the amendment is, are we moving in the right direction toward clarity? Not have we achieved it, but the words that we have, even with the amendments, still are subject to interpretation.
Okay. I also had a question, and maybe you can just help explain why it was drafted this way. It's sort of like using definitions to define a word using the same words, and that's in line 7 and 8 where you talk about real and personal property of all Indians residing upon federally recognized Indian country that is located in federally recognized Indian country. It seems rather redundant.
I have the same issue when we had the last discussion of this bill draft.
95 session?
Well, no, before it came over to Legislative Council for drafting. And I actually came up with a solution, but it took me a couple of minutes. If you'll give me a second, I'll...
Okay.
I have the same question, though, and it is circular.
Mr. Chair?
I think he's thinking. Oh. Let's not interrupt.
Interfere with that.
It's the property of Indians residing on federally recognized Indian country that is located. Part of it, I think my answer then was that within Indian country, within the boundaries of an Indian country, whatever they are, you have isolated parcels. So sometimes it's within. But I was puzzled by that myself.
Well, that also raises another question.
That particular text didn't come from me. It came from when I sent the draft over. It was changed, and I didn't see the issue until at the end of the drafting. I gave them some concepts, and then there was some play with that. I draft.
I think I did this. The first federally recognized Indian country refers to where the Indians are residing, that is, real and personal property of all of Indians residing upon federally recognized Indian country. And then the second, that is located in federally recognized Indian country, would deal, it addresses the property, because you may have personal property owned by a person living in federally recognized Indian country. That personal property may not be located on federally recognized Indian country, in which case then that property would not be exempt. So it has to be both. The person has to be residing and the property has to be located on.
Sure. I agree with Representative Sherwood. And I couldn't recall it exactly, but that is, in this, to clarify that, one way to do it is to move that expression that is located in federally recognized Indian country up following the words, the real and personal property. So it modifies directly the antecedent words. So you would say the real and personal property that is located in federally recognized Indian country of Indians residing upon federally recognized country. And then you separated those words. Where they are leads to questions.
Well, now that raises another question in my mind, but you talked about isolated parcels, and I think that's a concern that Mr. and Mrs. Stoll have brought forward a number of times. What does this do? Does it have any effect on private property owned by non-Indians that is now within the borders of an Indian reservation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely not, and I'll say that in two respects. That is definitely not the intent, and I don't see even the possibility of that in the language. But I try to keep my mind open, and if I heard an argument that was persuasive, I would change it. But I don't see it in the language. I don't see how this can address the parcels of non-Indians that are isolated within reservations or other Indian country.
And if they chose to sell their property at some point, would they be able to do that and not have any interference from the tribes as far as who they transfer the property to?
I assume this is owned by non-Indians.
Right.
And it's
within the borders of what is now an Indian reservation.
I do not see why not. Certainly this law would have no effect on that ability, one way or the other. And this law will not take away from that ability, that current ability that exists.
Okay. This is, I asked you to look up some of the other Supreme Court decisions that Mr. and Mrs. Stoll brought forward. Can you tell us what you found there?
Well, basically with the Cass County, and you're familiar with this, but one thing that was coming out of there is that you can't have sales tax at all, and that you can only have the ad valorem taxation. And as you were talking about, certain types of parcels of land are going to be exempt from taxes, but others are not. And so there may be a few parcels of land currently that that could have taxes imposed on them, and then when we're passing this legislation, then that would expand that exemption slightly on those parcels of land. So that was kind of a distinction that was being made there according to the passage of the treaty, as far as whether or not it said in there, explicitly said that there was a mention of taxation. So I think that was one of the main conclusions from that case. And then with the county of Yakima, that was the one where it was basically saying that there was not to be having any sales tax, but you could assess an ad valorem taxes owned if they were the tribes that had actually had the act, which explicitly said that you could have taxation. But I guess my question to you, Mr. Mayor, also is, you know, when we expand the personal property, are there other cases that have, you know, demonstrated that personal property is, because what I was hearing from these cases is that it has to be taxation of the land, you know, only taxation of the land.
No, Mr. Chair, the general rule, if it's owned by an enrolled member of the tribe, and the personal property is owned by an enrolled member of the tribe whose trust lands, on whose trust lands that tribal member resides, that is exempt. And I can give you the case. I have it in my office. I didn't bring it with me this morning, but I do have the site. That's the general rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does Senate Bill 245 go beyond what is required by federal law in terms of the tax-exempt status of this property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, it does go beyond what federal law requires.
Okay. To what extent and how?
The way I would put it is this way. For purposes of those lands that were allotted to the Indians during this period of time from 1887 to, I believe it was, 1934, there was legislation during that period which allotted lands to the Indians that was freely alienable by the Indians. The Indians could transfer it away. During that period of time, if the land was acquired by the Indian and was freely alienable, that land is subject to state taxation. Most of the formal reservations, however, were established before 1887. Most of the property, now one of the issues that's coming up in the end, the CAF decision especially addressed this. What happens if the land reacquires by purchase land and puts it into a reservation which is then, or into a, an area which the Indian tribe wants to be part of a reservation, and transfers that back to the federal government for a new reservation? The Supreme Court says if the land was acquired during this period, under one of these acts from 1887 to 1934, and is acquired, notwithstanding the fact that it becomes part of a later reservation, it is still taxable. So you cannot enlarge later by acquisition the lands that are tax exempt.
Mr. Chairman, can I tell you, what is the public policy reason here of going beyond federal law in terms of declaring this property tax exempt?
The reason that was articulated to me by revenue was that the tax assessors simply do not have the staff or the competence to make all of these individual property determinations with respect to these parcels that were conveyed to the Indians from 1887 to 1934. It is just too cumbersome to separate those out from the general group of parcels in Indian land. Technically very difficult. And I would say that's a reasonable judgment. It is very difficult. Another approach is to create a presumption that it's taxable and let the tribe assert that it's tax exempt.
I've been rereading some of this while you were talking, and I think I understand now the double hit on this, and that is that the property of Indians residing in Indian country that is then also within Indian country is what we're talking about. So we could have somebody, an Indian who lives within Indian country who owns land somewhere else.
Taxable.
Only if they live, and they could also own land within Indian country but live outside, and then it would, that would, it sounds to me like that would be taxable.
Chair Strobeck, I don't know the answer to that question. I would want to research that one. I'm really not certain about that. That's very an unusual.
It's a double test.
It is a double test.
It
definitely is. But I, from your last hypothetical, I have not seen that in any of the cases I've looked at yet, so I'm not sure what the answer is.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Strobeck?
I think that is a good point, that if you have an Indian who is residing off of the federally recognized Indian country, but who either owns real property in fee that's located within the Indian country, or owns personal property, wherever that might be, a motorhome or something located on Indian country, as I read this, that property would not be exempt from taxation, but would be taxable because the taxpayer, the owner, is not residing on federally recognized Indian country. So I see this as both tests having to be required.
Okay.
Does that help the assessors? I'm not sure that helps the assessors. Then they need to know where the owner is living.
With respect to certain types of personal property, that's not so difficult. So the presumption of a mobile home, for instance, or manufactured structure, is that you reside in the thing you own. But it's a presumption, and the facts may be otherwise.
Do we have a revenue forecast on this, a revenue impact?
Well, Representative Witt, from what I was told by counties, is that they're currently not taxing the land or the personal property.
Do we have a revenue impact as to what revenue would be being collected if we were taxing the land that and the property that should be subject to tax, I believe, under current law?
Yeah, Representative Witt, no. I mean, counties are not going out to really assess that.
Any other questions for Mr. Muir? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Ms. Stoll, did you want to make some comments?
Chairman Strobeck and committee, I feel like I just got my pumps tanked. This has been so confusing what he's been saying.
Could you just identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Kathy Soule from Danzond. As it is now, I understood Mr. Muir to say that Indian country and reservation are more or less synonymous, which is absolutely not true. Reservation land has been established by our U.S. Congress. Every single piece, every parcel is identified by federal law. And it is not Indian country. It is reservation. When the tribes put individual parcels into the trust, they go to the county, they have a written thing, I believe the BIA does it. It describes book, page, verse, everything else. Exactly which parcel they're requesting comes off the tax rolls. I've seen them. And just to throw it all into one big kettle and call it Indian country scares me to death. Indian country, from talking with an attorney in Arizona, she said Indian country will allow the tribes to tax us, which is totally unconstitutional. And I'll tell you what, other, I brought this around to everybody. On this public hearing from, I don't know what day it is, if anybody read this, it says that Jim Maneri said, extended an exemption beyond tribal boundaries. Where are tribal boundaries? Where is Indian land? Where is this Indian country? What is going on here? I feel treason all over the place. And I don't know how to express it except my this
these proposed amendments. In case you intend to pass this bill out, please consider these amendments. The term federally recognized Indian country, I never used. It's recorded in this thing that I used federally recognized Indian country. I did not. I do not know what federally recognized Indian country is. But in my proposed amendments, I used it assuming, because I was told by Mrs. Snodgrass's guy that being it passed the Senate unanimously, it'll pass the House. And I was told by somebody else that it's going to pass. The only hope is an amendment. So I'm sorry. Oh, I want to tell you something else. I am not sure where Mr. Muir is coming from, but on the thing that I testified May 4th, I brought up the U.S. Supreme Court's June 8th, 98 decision on Cass County, Minnesota et al. Versus Leech Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and they held, quote, state and local governments may impose ad valorem taxes on reservation land, not Indian country, reservation land, that was made alienable by Congress and sold to non-Indians but was later repurchased by the tribe. It's as clear as it can get. That's the intent of the latest case law. So I propose... if I could back up on this bill a little bit. What's being deleted is so terribly important. It says 307180, real and personal property, that's added, and situated on an Indian reservation. That's different from Indian country. That is defined. That shows the boundary. And then the very last line of the existing bill, it says, and the personal property of such Indians upon reservation shall be exempt from taxation only when so provided by any law of the United States. Why does the Revenue Department want to jump out ahead of the federal section? I'm proposing on line 12, section 2, line 14, section 3. This bill is for the sole purpose of codifying the personal property tax exemptions as they are now practiced by county assessors in Oregon and for no other purpose. And I've been told, and it is written, that they're doing it now. The first revenue report that came out said the assessors are all taxing their personal property now. On line 17, section 4, this bill does not affect any real property because you see by the definition of Indian country rather than reservation or the way it is now, by deleting these things, it will affect real property also. Section 5, this bill does not grant but specifically prohibits tribes, whether called dependent Indian communities or whether within federally recognized Indian country, from exercising any jurisdiction whatever over non-Indians. No taxation of non-Indians' real estate nor personal property, but they can't tax us. Nor businesses, nor utilities, nor sales tax, nor in any other manner claim or exercise jurisdiction over non-Indians within federally recognized Indian country or within dependent Indian community. And then Section 6, this bill confines any tax refunds allowed by Section 1 of ORS 307180 to taxes paid by tribes or individual Indians and for the portion of such taxes paid for other than schools. We don't have the money to refund all these taxes back to 1993. Dependent Indian communities. Let me kind of tell you that Mr. Muir, in his two-page letter, he talks about dependent Indian communities. Well, out there in Grand Ronde, we have a situation where the tribe has built a community center for the tribe. And yet, we have all kinds of governmental entities, council of governments, members of Polk County staff, Wayne Rickert from council of governments also, They call our regional problem solving, which is a hoax on all of us, this regional problem solving thing. They say the meetings will be at the tribal community center. Then when they do the minutes, they say the community center. A lot of people won't go because it's not on our land. We got the school right there. We can have the meetings in the school. So dependent Indian community is very much in the forefront of what's going on right now. I can't. There's so much more I want to say. Please don't vote for this bill at all. Thank you.
Thank you for your work, and we sure appreciate you taking the time and energy that we know you put into it, and the stress that obviously has been on you, and we're very, very sympathetic.
Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Bull? Jim Merklin?
If I understand, your fundamental concern is that, if I understand you right, you're concerned that the tribe may tax your land?
Yes. Yes, they are doing this in many, many, many tribal communities or reservations. Yes.
I can't see how this piece of legislation, which doesn't address that issue.
No, it doesn't. But establishing the term federally recognized Indian country does. And from there, it takes off into a can of worms or a can of snakes. I brought along an article. I don't know how much to say. This is a cover story about New York's Oneida and Madison counties. The tribes have given eviction notice to 20,000 different non-Indians that bought their property there. They've given eviction notices. I'll be glad to leave this issue. I had it faxed to me. To file the motion to expand the land claim lawsuit to include as defendants 20,000 representatives of the landowner class. This had the effect of threatening property owners in Madison and Oneida counties with eviction. This going on all over the United States. I don't know. See, our press doesn't tell the truth. They don't tell us what's going on.
I won't ask you too much more about it, but I think that concern that you have would be true, a concern, equally concerned whether or not we pass this legislation. But I don't think it's affected by the substance of this.
Oh, very much so, Representative Merkley. Very, very much so. Please don't establish that term. And I'll tell you what, if the assessors don't have a problem now, they know exactly book and page what land they're taking off the tax rolls. If you just throw it open to Indian country, what are they going to do then? And then Mr. Mayor said, according to this paper, that it extends an exemption beyond tribal boundaries. Where are tribal boundaries? Where is Indian country? Draw a map. Show us exactly what 245 will affect.
Thank you so much.
You know what? I notice Mr. Shetterly leaves every time I talk. It kind of bothers me a little bit.
Come and go as others.
I know, but I want him to hear this. It's just a little comment. When the Grand Run tribe wanted to be restored, the tribe sent a letter to the city of Willamina to Mayor Eddy, the city of Willamina. And we lived in Willamina at the time. This was in 82, I think. Anyway, the tribe cared so much about the city of Willamina, the mayor was Jack Shetterly. It wasn't Francis Eddy. But anyway, Mr. Shetterly, we bought our property from his client, and
He knew everybody that was here yesterday, too.
I know it.
Okay, well, I think what, my opinion is that I think Mr. Muir raised some of the questions. If there's any way that this language could be more precisely defined or drafted in some of the ways that would help the assessors and not introduce additional ambiguity and confusion into the statutes. I think that would be preferable. Or even not to pass this, because what the difference is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not passing the legislation is not going to harm Oregon, because we're still subject to federal law. Federal law is supreme, and it will determine our advice concerning what we can and cannot do. Mrs. Stoll is correct. There is an issue concerning the identification of Indian country. But I will tell you, and that raises a practical issue, and I can understand your concern about not knowing where the boundaries are when we change from an expression reservation, which is well understood, to Indian country, which is not so well understood. But nevertheless, the U.S. Supreme Court said emphatically in that Oklahoma case, because in that case, the property, the area in question was not on a reservation. That the immunity from tax power that the Indians enjoyed in Oklahoma was not limited to whether the tribal member lived on a reservation, because those tribal members were in dependent Indian communities. And so we will have to face that issue, if not in this legislation, as we're dealing with the parcels on a parcel-by-parcel basis. I don't have... Going back to your question, do we have any language ready for you at the moment? It depends on what your objective is. The simplest way to say it is that the property shall be taxed unless exempt under federal law, but that will require a case-by-case determination, as I've indicated earlier. And there are, even if you try to go the other way and spell out more exactly what that means, at the end of that process, you're going to be left with uncertain terms like allotments and dependent Indian communities and what is Indian country at this point, because it is not altogether clear what the Supreme Court means. So in answer to your question, we can maybe make some better, more progress, but in the end, it'll still be uncertain.
Mr. Minier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Jim Minier of the Department of Revenue. I guess when we submitted this bill, we never anticipated that, I can't even remember the 1887 to 1994 properties is an exception. I suggest all we're trying to do, and maybe this is all you ought to say in the statute, is that the property of Indians shall be exempt as required by federal law. I mean, given this discussion, our first goal was to get rid of some of this old language about severalty and things that confused the assessors. That was our main objective. And I didn't know that it was going to get into all of this confusing law. I guess the Supreme Court's case is in transition, and we'd be happy just to have you say that in the statute.
You know, I think that might be the simplest thing. Then it also gets Representative Witt's question, which is why would we go beyond in granting additional exemptions?
We haven't had any great issues over the exemption so far that have driven this. So we were only trying to.
Yeah.
Clean up the statute.
I understand. Okay. Well, would you work with counsel?
Be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Albert.
Yeah, you know, I think that would work if it says the personal property of Indians shall be exempt according to federal law. Is that what you said?
No. Mr. Chair, I'm going to say the property of Indians.
But we're talking about personal property.
The property of Indians shall be exempt as required by federal law, whether that's personal or real. You can put anything in the statute, and federal law will govern. So all we'll do is just tie it in so that no more is exempted than that. That's what I'll ask the legislative council to look at.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the session on Senate Bill 245. Open public hearing 2625. Is anybody here to speak on 2625 who didn't speak yesterday? Just in testimony. If there's any questions, Ms. Chambers will ask you to come up. Okay, close the public hearing and open the work session until 2625. Elizabeth, what have you discovered since yesterday?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I kind of went on the mission of trying to find a little more information on the personal property aspects of increasing this the processing area from 10,000 square feet to 40,000 square feet. But I think first I'd like to step back and just make sure everybody's clear on exactly where the problems are lying, because there's a lot of confusion and controversy over just what the actual current law should be in the interpretation of the current law. So what I gave you to begin with were just a kind of a flow chart of what are the changes from the considering current law, and we really have what got changed with Senate Bill 544 in the 1997 session was ORS 215.203, which establishes a meaning for farm use. And I gave you those statutes and stuff too so you can have them. But basically, this is a very important statute, and once it, from talking with the Attorney General's office and stuff, they feel like once this statute and you have a particular employment, current employment of the land being defined in there, then this is something that could then be allowed as a farm use. Okay, and once you're allowed as a farm use in ORS 215.203, then you get this allowing the property tax exemption for personal property. Okay, so that's the connection between 215 and 203 and 307-400, which is allowing the personal property tax exemption, that right now in current law is not real clear. And the reason why it's not real clear is because under 2A of 215.203 statutes under farm use, under the farm use definition, it still does not include the words processing. Okay, when Tom Linares was talking yesterday about there always being this clear distinction between preparing and storing the farm commodity, there never was processing involved in that, and it wasn't included here in 2A. So that's kind of the distinction. But with Senate Bill 544, 2B got changed. And with 2B, then we had the inclusion of subsection F there that said, except for land under a single-family dwelling and land under building supporting an accepted farm practice, including the processing facilities allowed by ORS 215.213 and 215.283, which are the two statutes that we're changing now in House Bill 2625. So just recognize that all we've done with Senate Bill 544 two years ago is change subsection F, or include this subsection F, and then allow in the words for processing facilities, but we say land under. So what the counties have interpreted this as is then that just the land is what should be given the special assessment, and then that leads you to 308.370 as far as giving the special assessment. But the question is, and what is coming under question, is whether or not if you've edited 2B, which is determining the current employment of the land, if that also then allows you to have farm use on that land. So I think that's what maybe could be used to be clarified according to how you feel like 2 years ago that was put into statute and what was the intent of the legislature then. Because right now there's not a clear lead between 2B to 2A and incorporating and processing them as a farm use, and then moving on to your statutes which are allowing the property tax exemption. And that's why there was this disagreement yesterday on testimony where, you know, people were saying that the personal property was also going to be exempt. And, the counties are not doing that. When we went and surveyed again yesterday, there was not one county who said, of those processing facilities that are 10,000 square feet or less processing area, were not giving a personal property tax exemption for their processing equipment that was movable. So that's kind of where the problems are currently lying. But if you're accepting that the current statute is being interpreted correctly by the county, then again, you would only be having land as being specially assessed, and then, like I was talking about before, you'd have about $5,800 as an estimate of how much per facility there would be in a tax credit. And then I looked a lot at wineries, just because that was is another bill that's exempting the personal property of wineries. So we had another study already kind of done by the Department of Revenue on that. So that's what this is giving you, this table here, is the winery survey, and then kind of combining it with the other survey the Department of Revenue did as far as what counties felt like were processing facilities that would be affected by House Bill 2625. So with this wineries, just looking at the wineries alone, if you were to consider that the current statute was not being interpreted correctly and that we would also have to be allowing personal property to be exempt, then just from the wineries alone, you're seeing a reduction of about $16.3 million in value as you're going off the rolls in a given year, and that corresponds to about $236,000. So that's kind of the issue that's before us, in the sense that there really is not much clarity in the current statute. So if you can come to an agreement of how you feel like the legislature should be interpreting this and how you want this exemption to be, if you want it just to be for land only, then we probably need council to draft some additional amendments to make sure we get this correct, because I think as it currently stands, there's a great bit of ambiguity as far as thinking also that personal property could also be exempt. And if you would like to have the personal property also exempt and the statute 307.400, you know, it shouldn't take a whole lot of editing in this bill in order to kind of accomplish that. And just so that you're aware of, I did kind of look 2 years ago at the initial revenue impact that was done for Senate Bill 588. And the very first sentence on the revenue impact is, you know, according to data gathered by the Department of Revenue, approximately $70 million in value would be exempt from taxation by the provision allowing farm use assessment on land under agricultural processing facilities. So they assumed 2 years ago that it was just farm use assessment on land under those agricultural processing facilities. So they did not talk about personal property at all in this revenue impact.
Okay. Does everybody understand everything then?
Okay.
Mr. Douglas or Ms. Chambers, do you have anything you want to add? Representative Welsh, you just made a comment that was your understanding that we're just talking about land, is that right? Is that your understanding? That's what you're asking for, is just the land issue?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Rob Douglas from the Oregon Food Processors Council. It's a little confusing because the initial revenue impact that came back yesterday from staff was very small, land only. Now we find out that there are no counties that are exempting personal property currently. We do not feel this has a huge revenue impact. We didn't know what the problem was, frankly, with the initial revenue impact statement yesterday.
So if we're allowing the size of the structure to get larger, we're not changing any tax issue on the land, whether there was any structure on it or not. Is that what you're...
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And one of the things you pointed out yesterday is we learned a lot. We learned that the building's taxable regardless.
Right.
And again, I would just come back to Carlin's point, which she stated so much better than I. The economic activity is going to generate more revenue to government.
Right. And then the other issue is the land use issue, which is a question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little confused on that, very frankly, because this bill has already been through one committee, Chair Welsh's committee. And down there, we kept hearing it's not a land use issue, it's a revenue issue. And now we get to the revenue committee, and it's becoming a land use issue again. So forgive me, but I'm a little bit confused on that point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, any other discussion on this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I guess my only concern that we didn't have yesterday is whether there's an ambiguity in the law right now, which is really just they're waiting for somebody to challenge language that's unclear. I mean, I guess we could be making a record here of what our intention is, that this only apply to land, but are we failing to pick something that maybe should have been spelled out last session, if that is indeed the case? Realize that's not what the bill set out. Your original one
did. Well, Representative Rosenbaum, I'll just, you know, reiterate that yesterday was, you know, full of different people's comments on this legislation, and, you know, everybody had different opinion, and by the end of the day, I was hearing that the counties were not doing what was currently going to be interpreted as correct. So, I mean, legislative council told me that this was fine the way they were doing it, but then I got a call from the Attorney General's office to know that I wasn't right thing. So I don't know if these are just quick decisions that everybody's making, you know, without, you know, completely looking at all the different facts, but I think there's some ambiguity there. Or else we wouldn't be having these kind of conversations with the attorneys having different opinions.
Gil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon County Staff. The core of our concern was that you are backing into some pretty profound policy implications when you start exempting processing equipment, personal property. If your intention is to limit this to the land underneath the building, then that core concern of ours is satisfied as long as it's clear. Now, we interpret clearly. We look at the law differently than apparently the counties that were surveyed are practicing it. So it would be helpful if this committee clarified that it's the land only. I'm speaking only in terms of the revenue issue. Now, currently there may be land use issues, but
not in this committee.
our request would be, if the intention is land only, then if you state that clearly, then that our core concern, revenue policies, is satisfied.
Okay. I believe that what I've heard from committee members is that is absolutely the understanding that we have and the intent. Anybody have a different opinion?
Mr. Chairman, the other point is this statute was put into effect 2 years ago, and all we're doing here is going from $10,000 to $40,000, and the counties have all interpreted not to exempt personal property. And my reading of it doesn't exempt personal property.
I agree. I think we're talking only about the land here, though.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shetterling?
Well, I appreciate it's not a land use bill. I do have some land use concerns about this. I think to say that all we're doing is going from $10,000 to $40,000 square feet, it's a fourfold increase in the size of facilities that we'll be accommodating in farm use zones. I want to spend some more time on this. I'm willing to, if the chair needs my vote to get it out to the floor, I'm willing to do that. But I will say that in reserving my... I may vote against it on the floor if my land use concerns aren't resolved by the time it comes up.
Okay. Mr. Welch, you want to make a motion?
I move House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Welch moves House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Opposing this bill for the same reason I opposed it in its earlier committee, which is simply that it removes the good neighbor provisions. And as you go to a large processing facility that's covering nearly an acre in size, it seems reasonable to ask before it's approved whether it's going to impact farming practices on adjacent land or whether it's going to increase the cost of farming on adjacent land. And those are very reasonable provisions under the current process that will be bypassed by this legislation.
Okay, other discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative McCoy. Aye. Representative Merkley. No. Representative Rosenbaum. Aye. Representative Steadley. Aye. Representative Welch. Aye. Representative Witt. Aye. Vice Chair Rasmussen. No. Jeff Probate. Aye.
So 2625 goes forward with the due pass recommendation. Representative Welch, will you please carry the bill? Thank you all very much. Thanks for coming back. We're adjourned. Until tomorrow. What's the order there? Yeah.